latest episode of the Accessing Justice podcast from CommuniCourt. In this episode, we're sharing a talk delivered at our 2023 Access to Justice conference. Presented by Carmen Melly KC of Park Square Barristers, this thought-provoking talk explores trauma-informed practice when working with vulnerable witnesses and defendants in legal proceedings. Karma considers how we can step outside of the special measures set out in the Youth Justice and Criminal Evidence Act in order to implement person-centred adjustments which ensure court users can give their best evidence. One of the six senior trainers who helped develop the National Training for Vulnerable Witnesses, Karma's practice with young defendants, particularly, has been described by the Court of Appeal as a model. She's also the bar representative with the Ministry of Justice for the Section 28 scheme to pre-record evidence. Among her many other roles, Karma sits part-time as a judge in the Crown and Family Courts. We were very privileged to have access to Karma's wealth of experience and knowledge at the Access to Justice conference, where her talk, which you're about to hear, served as a rallying cry for all professionals in legal proceedings to think more flexibly and holistically about how we facilitate the evidence of vulnerable court users and how we manage the re-traumatising aspects of giving evidence. So, without further ado, over to Karma.
So I've been in practice since 1997. I started off primarily defending in cases, as is the way with many women in the criminal justice system. I ended up dealing with a lot of children and vulnerable women. And in as much as to begin with, I wanted to kind of rage against that because I felt I was being instructed in such work because of my sex rather than my ability, I actually found that I enjoyed that work immensely. I found it incredibly rewarding to try and deal with children who have no voice within the criminal justice system and be able to find ways in which they could take a full part in the case. As I matured into the role and then I went on and took Silk, I have predominantly since then, so since about 2016, predominantly prosecuted cases. So still involved often with children, child defendants, child witnesses, now normally charged with murder or rape rather than robberies and thefts. One of the last cases I did before I took Silk, where I was being led, was a woman was on trial for murder. The only eyewitness was the seven-year-old in the home. And I was led by an eminent Silk, absolutely brilliant at his job, but perhaps not very used to dealing with seven-year-old witnesses. And there is a tendency at the bar quite often, and sometimes with judges, to make assumptions about children and that children will be operating at the level that their children and the children that they're used to operate at and to be able to use that sort of language. This wasn't a child who was used to middle-class intellectual discussions around the dinner table. And I sat and watched that seven-year-old being cross-examined for about an hour and a half without a break, until she agreed with absolutely every suggestion that the eminent Silk put. So there he was in his wig and gown, robustly telling her that she had got that wrong and perhaps it was X. And by the end, she was sat twiddling her hair, not looking at anybody and just going, yep, 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 yep. Now that was wonderful for our client, and our client was duly acquitted of murder, but I was left feeling extraordinarily uncomfortable about what I'd seen that child have to go through, and indeed, fundamentally, the quality of the evidence that was taken from that child. She was asked frequently if she wanted a break by the judge. She didn't want a break, she wanted that finished, and she wanted to go home, so she always said no to a break and no to being tired. And I was fuming really because I wanted that judge to take some control of that case and say, you need a break, because she was no longer listening or engaged. And perhaps that had a significant impact on me in terms of the ongoing work that we went on to do as regards the national training. And that's been run by the Inns of Court College of Advocacy in conjunction with a number of other organisations and delivered by the circuits, delivered by the Inns of Court I wholly recommend the resources that are on that website in terms of looking and planning. So in terms of picking up the very best tips in terms of advocacy preparation, I wholly recommend that as a resource. We developed that many years ago. It was a battle of hearts and minds in many places to get barristers, particularly defence barristers, to engage with that process. I think there was a genuine fear by the defence community that in adopting a training programme that in some way defendants wouldn't be robustly represented and their case wouldn't be put and witnesses wouldn't be challenged. So to begin with, what we really had to explain and get people to commit to was to see that this wasn't about not giving defendants a fair trial. It was ensuring that the questions were put, challenge was put, but in a way that didn't re-traumatise witnesses and actually try to get to the overwhelming objective of our criminal justice system, which of course is to convict the guilty and acquit the innocent. So one of the things then is to really inform you perhaps about, I think, what will be the next big stage in how we think about vulnerable witnesses and defendants within the criminal justice system, and hopefully across all of the justice systems, in fact, because these points, as has been made, are equally relevant to the family and civil systems as well. So driving change to improve the process and the outcome. This, I think, will be the very next big training programme that we all engage with, is to be better informed as regards trauma-informed questioning. At the moment, that's given, often referred to as trauma-informed lawyering, a phrase that I find slightly uncomfortable. But what fundamentally this is about is understanding and being aware of the fact that trauma in the lives of the witnesses or the defendant has a significant impact upon how evidence is delivered and how someone presents. We have to be aware when we're dealing with such individuals that there has frequently been trauma and that we are asking them often to recall that trauma publicly and be challenged about their trauma. You know, that's quite a shocking thing when you explain that to a witness. It may mean that they are being exposed within that courtroom, either through perhaps a voice or them actually physically there, by the person that caused them that trauma, by their abuser. They may be confronted with that. And we as lawyers working within the system need to understand the impact of that previous trauma and the fact we are often, and we have to accept that, playing a part in the re-traumatisation of those people within the courtroom. And the impact of that can mean that the witness finds it very difficult to disclose information or occurrences that are acutely relevant to what that judge or jury has to decide. That quite often their disclosure is accompanied with a real sense of shame. And we have to be aware also that the impact of that trauma can impact the evidence in a way that looks as though it impacts on their credibility. So what I mean is that sometimes the impact of that trauma and dealing with it and not wanting perhaps to answer it or not wanting to confront it or turning away could have in fact all those same signs that a judge or a jury is looking at to decide whether somebody or not is lying to them. So in terms of the role that I can see for advocates, but also intermediaries to identify those traumatic events and to explain to the court how that might impact upon the evidence. And the Inns of Court College of Advocacy is now developing a training program really looking at this issue, trauma-informed questioning or advocacy. And we're working with psychologists and counsellors in order to prepare that. And I can anticipate that will be part of our legal education in the next period of time. So that's one of the things that I just wanted to mention so that we were aware of that. The next learning point is a real consideration of the witnesses' needs. rather than starting with the Youth Justice and Criminal Evidence Act 1999. Now, we've just all heard about the measures from Neil Clark about what is available to a court, a list of different rules and of things that we can, sort of practical things, having a screen in a courtroom, and there's a list of them within the statute. And what I want to see is, rather than us going with that shopping list and working out which one the witness can sort of be forced into, it's just pausing sometimes and trying to work out what does that witness need, and then trying to create that in a way. Because although we have a list of rules there under the Youth Justice and Criminal Evidence Act, if you can think of some other way in order to really assist or support that witness, my experience is if you've given it proper thought, you've considered fairness from both sides, the court is often willing to go with a measure that is not listed in the statute. And it also means that a court will often go with that measure even for a defendant who isn't supposed to have the benefit of that list of special measures within the Youth Justice and Criminal Evidence Act. And my third bullet point that I will touch on as I whistle us through is that just to think about some of the practical steps that we could think about in achieving best evidence, because we've been running criminal trials. Yes, there have been changes, so defendants can give evidence, but certainly in my experience, which is getting close to 30 years, I feel like we just have been following the same order of evidence, the same format in all trials, without sometimes just pausing and thinking, could we do this differently? Are there other things that we could think about rather than just going along with what has always been done? So those are the things I will try and give us a whistle-stop tour of. So understanding the impact of trauma, just a little think about that. Lack of agency. Quite often we're dealing with children or adults who have not had control in their lives. They have had that taken away from them at a very, very young age. They've often had interactions with authority, with school, which leaves them with absolutely no trust and no respect for authority. So when you walk in and you think somebody's going to be overawed by the criminal justice system, the courts, and they'll know how to behave, they quite often might want to put two fingers up at that system because of the way that they've been treated. I now deal with an awful lot of grooming cases, so historical offences of child sexual exploitation. I'm dealing with women in their 30s, 40s and 50s who were, and there's no way of getting around this, failed by the systems as teenagers over and over again. They were not protected, they were not kept safe, they were blamed and thought and described by social workers as child prostitutes or authors of their own misfortune. So when we waltz in and tell them that this is what they need to do and this is going to be their support network and here are some police officers in their mind who drove them back to their attackers when they were teenagers, let's not criticize them for not always immediately trusting us because of their experiences within their life. And that lack of trust and respect often comes out in anger. And I've dealt with grooming cases where I've had to deal with women literally throwing chairs around in witness rooms outside because the sense of rage that not only have they been treated like that way their whole lives, they come to court, they're told everything's changed, they'll be listened to. But what they don't fully understand is if there's a criminal trial, they're being challenged. That means that by its very nature means that people aren't accepting what they've said, and that can be a real shock. So when I come on to practical steps, let's always try and have some furniture that's nailed into the floor just to look after the court staff who obviously don't really deserve chairs being flung at their heads. Okay, anxious need for confidence in arrangements, and that's what we heard, the lack of agency, the lack of trust, that need for just some control, some confidence in arrangements, and also the need for transparency. So ultimately, what we're really trying to look for is reliability, consistency, and predictability in the criminal justice system. Something that any of us who have worked in it know that we cannot deliver. I'm listing trials now for 2025 for grooming cases. That's how far away. These women reported it in maybe 2016, 2017. I've had a woman say to me recently, her child, who was 14 years of age, had no living memory of her not being involved in a prosecution. That's how long the cases go on for. And then when they come to court, there are often issues then, which mean there are delays, everything that was set up. And the impact of that is significant. What can we do then within this underfunded system, essentially? What can we do? There are some practical things that I've tried to think about just to give a sense of control. Perhaps when we're listing, or we're listing when that vulnerable witness is going to come to trial, thinking about, well, OK, I'm going to aim to call them on that day, but if it doesn't work out, I'm going to have a backup plan of the Thursday that week. In setting the Section 28 dates, will the court permit us? If that fails, can we get a backup date, please? So that we're not turning up at the Section 28 and then finding another date 3 months later. Manage expectations. Explaining from the very outset that a criminal trial involves so many moving parts that we actually do not ever realistically expect it to run to time. You've got 12 jurors, often, you know, 10 representatives, a handful of defendants potentially, an overstretched courtroom. We need all the equipment to be working. We need that witness to be there. And actually, when you start to explain how many moving parts there are, the witness comes to understand it's not personal. It's not about them not being given the respect that they deserve and need, but there just are issues. You know, we particularly over COVID with delays that were caused by that. So managing expectations, but in another way as well, let's not shy away from it. And I always have these conversations with defendants, with witnesses. You wouldn't be giving evidence if you weren't going to be challenged. You know, we've told them things have changed so much that I almost feel some witnesses just think they're coming to some sort of counselling session and they'll tell their story and everybody will tell them how awful it was. It is a shock as an adult to be told you're lying. It actually really doesn't happen very often. And to have someone of authority look you in the eye and call you a liar is absolutely shocking. And it fundamentally doesn't matter whether that person is saying, you're a liar, aren't you? Or Uncle Johnny says that he didn't do X. Is he telling the truth or not? They know what they're being asked is, what you're telling us isn't right. So manage that. Tell them you wouldn't be here. I know it seems obvious, but this really does come as a shock to a lot of witnesses when I explain this at the Speaking to Witnesses at Court protocol. Thinking about the order of witnesses, I've become a little bit evangelical about this because it's one of the things I do have control over as a prosecutor. So since I've ever seen criminal trials, we always call the victim first as the prosecution. So the trial starts, it's opened by the prosecution barrister, and then we call the first witness, we call the victim if we're dealing with a sexual offence. And then we call all the other evidence. And my experience, and I have absolutely no basis or data to support this, is that the further away we got from the victim's evidence, the less likely we were to get a conviction. Somehow, particularly over a weekend, so when I was defending, I was always quite happy to leave it till over the weekend. But the impact of it is just, it's lost quite quickly. We forget the evidence, or we must be able to bring that power of their testimony back to us. So what I've started to do is to call the victim as the last piece of evidence in cases that I prosecute. I call almost everything else, how an investigation runs. I explain all of that to the jury. I try and deal with the identification evidence, the scientific evidence, and I try to call the victim as late as I possibly can. And it has a number of impacts. It's closer in time to when the jury go out. You can often then see the evidence of the victim and the defendant much closer together, sometimes even on the same day. And that's been very, very powerful. And also, it gives me a little bit of control over the dates and keeping it as a fixed date. So if I put my most vulnerable witness, the victim, as the last evidence, all the things that were going to go wrong and inevitably do go wrong. The transcript hasn't come through, the video wasn't edited properly, that another witness has been ill. I can rejig all of that mess in that period and keep a fixed spot for the victim. And I don't have to mess them about as much. So really small practical arrangements can be helpful. Preparing the witness for escape routes. How do they get out of the cross-examination, defendant or a witness? If it's overwhelming, if they're dealing with trauma, give them some words. I give them words for it. So I tell them, if you need to just leave, then we set that up. I've had a witness who just, every time she was reminded of events, she needed to vomit, essentially. And we had waste bins there prepared for her. But also we cleared it with the judge that she didn't have to ask permission. She didn't have to ask the ISFA or the intermediary, could she leave? When it came too much, she had the permission to walk out of the courtroom with, and that was okayed by the judge in advance. And that gave her a real sense of security that she could do it. Thinking about where they can go out for a cigarette, practical arrangements like that make a real difference. So yeah, when I have the conversations about what people are often most scared about in terms of their actual evidence, they think that a clever lawyer is just going to keep saying, answer this yes or no, and then this yes or no, and then before they know it, they will have agreed to a set of circumstances that they never intended to. So I often have a conversation about, you know, if you are feel like you're being forced into a yes or no, or was it left, was it right, and you cannot give the explanation in that way, it wouldn't be a fair account, then what you can say is, I need to tell you more to be able to answer that. I need to explain my answer. And if they say those words, then the judge will have to let them explain that, or at least in re-examination, that'll be picked up by their own barrister. So giving them some actual language is about it. And this brings us on to the next point that we just need to just engage with. There isn't a right or wrong or an answer to this, but it needs to be thought about always. We don't just want to ensure, there is absolutely no point making the questioning for witnesses so anodyne that we don't get the outcome. So we need to think about the fact that sometimes the witness actually gives their very best evidence when they are fundamentally challenged about it. So when it is suggested to the defendant or the witness, they've made it all up for these reasons, and of course we deal with the language of how that is put, but watching that witness deal with the central point, what you're making it up for money, are you, or you've lied about so and so for whatever reasons to get out of trouble, the judge or the jury watching them deal with that central issue can have an enormous impact on the outcome. So we often have to think about then the balance between the process of the evidence and also the outcome. So we need to ensure the language of the advocacy is kept in check, but sometimes the non-challenging questions can mean that we don't always get the evidence that we want for which either side. So there needs to be a real consideration of what that witness can handle, and not just thinking about a general sort of set of rules. There is absolutely not one fit all in these questions. We have to think about it. And so that's what I mean also by dealing with the evidence by other means. When we first developed this training, and that's why Judge Clark is so right, we need to review and review it. We're in the early stages of development still, I think, in terms of how we handle vulnerable witnesses. When we began, we started to think, well, we won't ask them about this time that they lied at school, for example, this significant lie. That'll be hard for them to deal with. It'll be embarrassing. So we won't ask them about that. We'll just deduce that evidence that fundamentally undermines their credibility without letting them deal with it. Well, yeah, of course, it made the evidence much easier, the process much easier for the witness. Was it fair? No. Not really, because they might have lied at school. They might have a very good explanation for it. Sometimes letting them deal with the damaging material actually is better for the case and better for the witness. And I can't imagine, if you put yourself in their shoes, thinking that that would be acceptable, that people would agree facts about you and your credibility and your bad behaviour without you being given an opportunity to deal with it. And so often, what looked like something really damaging for that witness's credibility, they had a really good explanation for. So thinking about how we handle it. Because when we're thinking about trauma and the ongoing impact, we have to bear in mind that the outcome of that trial process is very significant in terms of them dealing with their trauma. It's not just about the process. There is no point for a victim, and I put it into a prosecution victim for a moment, there is no point them having a wonderful, easy ride through their cross-examination, but every single man that abused them was acquitted. That will not help them long term in terms of dealing with their trauma. So there needs to be an engagement between the process and the outcome. Let's return to issues of control that Chris was talking about as well. It was really interesting to hear him talk about the clutter in the courtroom and the state of our courts. These are some of the things that come up a lot in my conversations with defendants and with witnesses. And I mention them just because sometimes, and particularly as regards women, that when they raise issues about clothing or hair or how they should dress, it's kind of dealt with in a really dismissive way, as if they are being vain or concerned about things that aren't important. And so thinking about all of these issues and the things that we can control can be very, very significant in terms of giving the witness some control. We have a lot of issues with defendants' childcare, letting them down, and witnesses' childcare on the day. I've had nurseries that we've paid for just ring up, and then we've had no support. And I've had witnesses giving evidence about the most significant events when they know that a police officer now is collecting their child from reception in the first week of school. You know, and the judge has not given us time to deal with backup childcare. And that will impact on their evidence. So really thinking about all of these practical things, their support, their accommodation, how they highlight distress to be able to give them some control. Be careful with notes that you have. Be careful with files that you have in relation to people. It's really terrifying for a witness to think that there's documents over there about their personal life. I did some training as a volunteer for youth defendants. For a long time, I was a mentor. And one of the exercises they got the trainees to do was to write down a little secret, something they'd be embarrassed about their colleagues knew, and put it face down whilst we did other discussions, and how it impacted on our mind. And even though it was something so small, it wasn't like the trauma that the witnesses and defendants had. It was all I could think about. It was all we could all think about was that little secret written down about us. And it gave me a really good insight, I think, into just how disconcerting it can be for people to think that you have information about them. So how does trauma really impact on the evidence given? Quite often it can result in witnesses and defendants laughing and smiling and giggling or not looking like they're focusing. I've had witnesses walk out of court. The number of times I've run in my wig and gown up the road literally to try and bring witnesses back into court. I mentioned the need for a waste bin. I've had witnesses and defendants who have been alcohol or drug free for some years relapse over the process of a trial. It's been devastating, but just to sort of make them aware of that and try and make sure that there is some support for them. Final word about memory refreshing. We forget this sometimes. They give their statement, could have been 5 years ago, could have been 6 months before. We get to court. It's the same for witnesses as it is for defendants. We need them to read that statement. Even if they know it all, they tell you they know it all, they don't want to reread the witness statement or watch the video of their evidence, they will really do themselves a disservice if they don't engage with the memory refreshing. But it is particularly traumatic for witnesses, particularly to watch a video impact. So that needs to be taken with real caution and understanding. Sometimes I've said, don't watch it then. Hear it, turn away. Sometimes witnesses do not want to see them describe their own abuse. It's just too awful a process for them. But I don't allow people to read their own witness statements. Everybody who reads their own witness statements think that they know the content of it. They glance at it and put it to one side. I drive police officers crazy and my instructing solicitors crazy. I make the document be read to them. And they take it in much better and they remember some of the key phrases which are going to be used by the witness. So finally then, just a little think about special measures. Please also take cut and paste any intermediaries out of your reports. When I'm going in front of the judge at the same time with the same key phrases, they are less likely to allow me an intermediary because they just think it's a cut and paste job. So really start with the witness's needs. No assumptions, please. Witnesses often want to be in the court. Defendants might not want to, you know, they want to be there, they want to face the jury quite often. Section 28 has been amazing for a number of witnesses. It has a real purpose in our criminal justice system, but it doesn't meet every anxiety. So I've had some witnesses, I've been told I need Section 28, I go and meet them, and actually all they want is to not ever be in the same building as the perpetrators. And just then, finally, some examples of non-Youth Justice Criminal Evidence Act measures. So, I had a witness who had completed hundreds of video recorded interviews. She didn't want the defendants to see her face on the videos. That was really tricky to think about. How did we do it? We had to disclose the videos. I said, pixelate her face. Let's see what happens with the defence. We pixelated her face, and then of course we had to think about how we played in the courtroom the pixelated ones, so the defendants only saw the pixelated ones, the jury saw the non-pixelated ones, and we played them simultaneously with matching audio. Amazingly, it worked. So they never knew what she looked like now because she was still local in that area but had changed what she looked like. It was essential they couldn't see her. I've had judges in the link room. The Section 28 is being conducted with the link room, but the judge is in there with the child. That's been really, really effective. And then finally, just to mention, I had a 13-year-old young man who was on trial for a number of violent offences. He, when I met him in conference, could articulate and explain why he had behaved in that way. But when he was brought to court, he was 13, he was remanded in custody. By the time he was brought on the transport van, because they're brought from so far away sometimes, the children, he'd been on that van and then sat in a cell on his own because he couldn't be held with anybody else before he came to court for about 4 or 5 hours. And he was wired and aggressive and he couldn't give an account for himself and he was going to be convicted. And I had multiple conversations with the staff about what can we give him? No screens, nothing was permitted. Well, he can have a book. Well, that's great because he doesn't really read. So I said, can I bring in some comics for him? He could read a little bit. No, because the staples. Okay, I got some hardback Beanos from my son. Can he have these? No, the edges are too sharp. So I filed off all the edges of the Beano albums and he had soft Beanos and they permitted those. And he'd never had his own books before and he absolutely loved these hardback Beanos and he would sit there and pore over them, improve his reading. And it meant he was calm and in control, so by the time he gave to give his evidence, he could give a really good account for himself. And he was ultimately acquitted of all charges, and I think it's down to Nasha. So thank you very much.
Listening to the Accessing Justice podcast, and a huge thank you to Karma Melly KC. We'll include links to resources mentioned by Karma in the episode notes, including the excellent Inns of Court College of Advocacy e-learning courses, which are free to access, and cover topics including advocacy and vulnerability in the family justice system, and advocacy for children in conflict with the law. If you'd like to learn more about the role of intermediaries in legal proceedings, CommuniCourt has developed a library of free, bite-sized resources for legal professionals called the Access Brief, which is available through the CommuniCourt website. In the Access Brief, you will find guides to working with an intermediary at all stages of proceedings, as well as specific guides to working with a client who has a diagnosis impacting their communication, from autism to traumatic brain injury. Thank you again for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you next time.